Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Giancarlo Esposito. And if you love TV and movies, you must subscribe to Watch Less podcast with Carl and Fraser.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to Watch Less, Complex's movie and TV podcast hosted by myself, the Summer Man, and the big pop culture deputy, Cal.
What's good, Joe?
Ever since the protests started and it kicked up other conversations about representation and other corners of different industries, we over here have been having some very, even more interesting, I should say, conversations with our guests. You know, Cal, actually, in this episode, you point out this isn't a political podcast, which it's not. It's a pop culture podcast. But especially following like the 2016 election and everything, there gets to be a point where politics of everything is kind of unavoidable.
Yeah, this is the conversation.
Exactly. And you're doing a disservice if you're not engaging people on these things. And there are different ways to engage it within your specific vectors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with our guests, some of color, some not, we've been having like some really, really, really interesting conversations about representation in Hollywood, mm-hmm. how that can be fixed, the ways in which it faltered to begin with. And today's guest is one of the best people to engage on that subject, Giancarlo Esposito.
Legend.
I mean, you've seen this guy in numerous things, but
everything.
One of the most seminal works that he's a part of that's been being invoked right now is Do the Right Thing, which of course is unfortunately all too prescient. And, you know, who better than bugging out himself to weigh in on how things have come full circle and how some things haven't changed at all. And just as a biracial man himself, he has a ton of insightful stuff to say about race in Hollywood and the ways that it can be fixed and the ways that it's been, you know, the areas we haven't even been looking at. You know, he brings up a really good point about how biracial characters are kind of in this middle zone where they never really get the due that they deserve.
Word. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's a dope perspective to have because he's a guy who wasn't born here. Yep. And on this episode, he talks a lot about how he learned about race and color through, you know, just being a mixed kid growing up in America. Like it's probably one of the, I guess, worst ways to learn about those things. Cause you never learn about being a black person or like of any race that isn't quote unquote desirable to some in a good way. It's not like, oh, hey, black guy was going on. It's always like, you know, there's always some trauma or some like fucked up story that goes along with it. So,
exactly.
It's dope again. And again, you mentioned Do the Right Thing. Anytime, you know, over the last, what, 4 or 5 years? I guess since Eric Garner, I feel like you end up, whenever there's an unfortunate, tragic situation like this with the police and a black individual, especially with, like, a chokehold, that movie, that scene with Radio Raheem is an automatic. I remember, it's crazy that, because I would have been, what, 9, 10 years old. That was the first Spike Lee movie I think I saw. Probably the first Giancarlo acting role I'd ever seen. It's a heavyweight film. It's a heavyweight film, but he's also done so much since, you know, he's on that award season wave right now. He's back as Gus Fring.
Big Gus.
Penultimate season of Better Call Saul ended earlier this year. And, you know,
wait, we got to let them know about Better Call Saul, the Complex's official best show of the year.
If you didn't catch it on Monday, the best TV show so far of this year dropped. And yeah, number one. And it was, Curb was great. Solid. There's something about Saul. I wish, like, the stuff we got Giancarlo, we saw Giancarlo doing his Gus this season was really great. I feel like it's really ramping up to a spectacular final season. But we didn't get to see as much as I would have liked to. It's interesting to, you know, to talk to him about, because we go all the way back to, you know, when he first linked up with Vince and the crew at Breaking Bad to at least try and figure out if he'd want to do it. And it's funny to say that, you know, there's these roles that are so iconic for some actors, and you know, one false comment, one wrong comment, and we might not have ever had Giancarlo as Gus. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's dope to see that come. And he talks about that. He talks about being able to rediscover a character that was already iconic and he already played it. I don't know. It's funny to see people like him and Ashley Murray, like, they're kind of embarking on these new adventures as actors playing roles and sticking to roles for over long periods of time, especially time where there's actual chronological time in between the different periods of the series that they're playing.
That's a good point too that you bring up. It's like you got the really special actors can find a way to make playing the same person not just the same thing.
Word.
If that makes sense.
It takes a good actor, also takes a good creator, because they could have easily fucked, you know, Gus up the second time around, and gladly they stepped it up. Again, but we don't just talk Better Call Saul with them, but there's a lot of it. You know, he does mention talking about playing a younger Gus. He talks a lot about being a black actor in America. I mean, that dichotomy is real.
Another good thing that he brought up that to your earlier point was he brings up how you can flip that trauma and not pay it forward, but overcome it, you know, for the next generation. You know, he grew up biracial, and now his children are biracial.
Mm-hmm.
And so he talks a lot about raising them and teaching them both sides and to love and respect both sides.
Again, a poignant conversation for a very important time and a very well-spoken guy doing it. Hell, we even get, you know, some random conversation about when he used to be a roommate with Lawrence Fishburne back in the day.
Right. It's not all super serious, too. And he's one of those guys who can engage on the serious stuff without being, you know, preachy about it or making it sound like a lecture. And he's also a guy who can, you know, weigh in on some of the more sensitive topics with some fun, too. And, you know, he doesn't shy away from anything. I mean, you couldn't get Giancarlo Esposito and not ask about his boy Aaron Paul being a part of the widely lambasted actors, I don't know, PSA, you would call it, that they did. So, you know, he touches on that too, and where that maybe went a little tone deaf. So he doesn't hold back.
Yeah. Pulls no punches. Fun interview. I mean, I want you guys to let us know after you listen to this episode, this interview, let us know where you rank this in the hierarchy of greatest watch less interviews so far. I feel like this is a good one. Get some popcorn, get a drink or two, or, you know, whatever you do. Do you treadmill? You don't listen to podcasts aside from us, right? And load management.
I do. When I do listen to, like, you know, the competition, it actually isn't. It is in the gym. That's the best place to do it.
Yeah, treadmill, riding a bike, whatever you do, you got some time. So tune in after this quick break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Watch Less. We're currently in a string of very, very special guests. Today is no exception. I want to say, I think the first time I saw this man in a film, it was probably Do the Right Thing. It's probably Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. He played Buggin' Out. It was probably, I would have been, gosh, 8, 9, 10 years old, something like that when I first saw it. And I think he was probably at that time, with Warrant, one of the angriest black men I'd ever seen on film. I greatly appreciated that, but I also greatly appreciated following his career as he grew. He was in a string of Spike Lee films, both before and after that, but he's blossomed. He's played drug dealers like Esteban is in Fresh, the film that I hold near and dear to my heart. He's had an amazing career. I know a number of people probably know him best these days as Gus Fring from Breaking Bad, and now in Better Call Saul, which is nearing the end of its time. Giancarlo Esposito, thank you for joining the Watch Less podcast.
Thank you. So happy to be here with you today.
How are things going? How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I've taken this time during this shelter at home period to redefine myself and my goals and values for the next few years. And that, of course, includes getting some equal justice for African Americans who've been dehumanized in our country. Mm-hmm. And so I've been thinking, what can I do to be in support of all humanity? Now it's become a world global movement. I'm very proud to have been able to survive being a black man for all these years, so, you know, which is not an easy feat. So I'm blessed to feel as if I've lived long enough that maybe I have some wisdom about me now, and some of that anger may have been channeled in a new direction. Yeah, it's been a good time.
We were actually talking about that before. It's been a blessing to be, because we've been, I mean, I guess we've been shelter in place since mid-March, and we had just started, you know, this podcast you're on now, maybe the November before, and we've been able to chuck along throughout. Thank God for the internet. We've been able to, you know, maintain our careers and everything, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. You know, when we can work from home and work through our Zoom calls and be connected somehow, it helps us with our craft, but it also helps us stay in touch with the world.
Yeah. Definitely. Now, Giancarlo, how have you been processing your creativity in quarantine as well? Are you still reading a steady stream of scripts, or even doing some hobbies you didn't know you had?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been gardening, which has been a great joy to be able to, because again, when everything started to close down, you know, I started thinking, okay, this could happen. And two of the words that came out of my mouth were civil unrest. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if that did happen, I'd just go out to the garden, I'd have to go out of the house, get my lettuce and my carrots and my beets and people to eat. So that's one of the things. The other thing is that I've been successfully recording from home, which mm-hmm. has been fantastic. My learning curve has been a little bit stunted because I haven't been in the studio in a long time doing my own engineering. When I was in college, I had my own radio show. Oh, and nice. So it was called Jazz Time with G, and I'd engineer myself and I'd spin discs and have a really good time. So it's bringing me back to realize I have, I'm a little technically challenged in our new world, but the way to do it is to sit down and work it out.
Yeah.
So I've got my little recording closet I do some recording from, which has been fun. Got two podcasts. Also did the wraparound introductions for a television show, which has been great. Could do that from my library, but I also was able to venture out and do some stuff, you know, out in the field on That's location. Awesome.
Nice. I'd seen something that during quarantine you were watching Breaking Bad as well. Is that true?
Yes. Well, you know, our I was watching actually the new season of Better Call Saul.
Okay.
Before it was actually on air.
Oh.
So I was watching all that to sort of get prepared. I have not gone back and watched all of Breaking Bad yet.
Oh, okay. Do you have plans to do that at any point? Because I do. Find it's interesting.
Because normally I don't watch what I do until until you've seen it. And, you know, I wait, especially if I'm doing a series, because I feel like creatively, if I am working on a series and watching it at the same time, I feel like sometimes I could get a little lost in what I do. And that could affect my next appearance. So I try to be in the reality, in the realistic zone, that I'm just playing this character until it's done. Yeah. And then when it's done, I can go back and go, oh, I was just the entertainment. I get it now.
Wait,
I get it now. It was a TV show. Well, I was actually living that.
I mean, you talk about living that. What's it like to live in a guy like Gus's head for a time? Like, are you super method when it comes to stuff like that?
Well, you know, I don't consider myself super method, but I like to stay in the character when I'm on set. And I certainly, on a day of shooting where I have a 6 or 8 o'clock call time, I'm certainly up at 4 thinking through the ramifications of what I'm about to do scripturally that day, what our story is and what it is. So maybe I am a bit method. I feel like I get in a space, a yogic space, because yoga was the impetus for me setting up and realizing Gus's calm nature. And it led me to the idea that he's more of an observer of people to figure out how to manipulate them. So within his observance, he checks off boxes. You know, this person wants this from life. This person aspires to do this. This person doesn't have the means to do this. And he figures out what a person may need and what that trade-off may be to go into business with that person. And so Gus is very thoughtful, which I like about him. He thinks about the future. He thinks about the bigger picture of things.
Do you inherit things like that from your character? I imagine not so much the darker sadistic side of Gus, obviously, but you know, Gus is, you know, he's suited up, you know, he's very particular, Queen. Very, yeah. Do you pick up anything like that from a character like this or any of your characters in general?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt. Things that I like, I pick up. Things I don't, I discard. But you know, part of Gus's look when he was outside of Los Cuatro Hermanos and not wearing the yellow shirt and the black tie was that he was very put together. So I suggested, in being put together, he should be a bit different. Mm-hmm. Why don't we do him in monochromatic colors? And that's how his look started, because it came out of a part of my own style that I carry, that mm-hmm. I lent to this character in order for me to feel like he's at home. Now, what it came out of, not only my own style, but to take it one step further, it came out of my thinking about this man's personality. And so when we think about personalities, we think about what makes us feel whole. And Gus is all about presentation. He's in the food industry. Mm-hmm. It's presentation. And in the way he presents himself, he's clean. He's very meticulous. He cares about how people react to his food and his drink and his attitude. And so in many ways, he guides you to where you need to be. And where he wants to have you for you to be able to contribute to his organization the way he wants you to contribute.
Gosh. You know, you talking about your input just led me to think about how collaborative it sounds like working with Vince Gilligan is. And it always kind of throws me when you think that Gus became such an integral part of the Breaking Bad narrative. And that wasn't even something that they had planned out from the beginning. Like the way his story is interwoven with, you know, the whole mythology and going back to other characters was kind of something that they just seized upon after you'd already joined the show.
It was, you know, I did the last two episodes of season two, and they were already asking me to come back before I got off the plane from the first episode. Mm. And I said I would, because I liked the way it was going. And so they said, after I did the second guest episode, would you come back for season three and sign a contract? I said, no, not right now. I would take a lot of conversation and be talking to Vince about what he had in mind. And so they said, are you sure? I said, yeah, you're going on hiatus. Why offer me a contract now?
Yeah.
So I sent them away, and they came back after hiatus, offered me the contract, at which point I expressed I wanted to speak to Vince. And in my conversations with Vince was this collaborative nature of someone who really wanted to be a part of a new and fresh idea. So once I said to him, look, your stage direction, hiding in plain sight, is what guided me to perform the way I did in the first two guest episodes that you had me on. So just so you know what I was thinking, I was honoring this hiding in plain sight. You don't know who you're meeting. You don't know what your neighbor's doing. And I was fascinated by that. So I took it a step further in talking to him about the kind of villain or non-villain businessman that I wanted to create. And he was fascinated by it. So yes, the collaborative feeling on this particular show, the sharing of ideas, was really a wonderful way to go about joining this show. However, when people collaborate, they lose their sense of what they originally intended or what they wanted. And that's not the case with Vince.
Okay.
Vince was so tickled by the idea of that character I wanted to create that he was inspired. And as he said to me, I was inspired by what you did in these episodes. And I said to him, well, I was equally inspired. And so that creates a wonderful collaboration. So your ego's not crushed if he says, no, I don't want to go that way. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. It's, but I do like this idea you had, and I do like this. And then what writers do, it's so weird, because actors, we're in a fishbowl, man. Like all the writers, producers, network people who chime in that we don't even know about have something to say about your performance. And they suggest to the writer, maybe that's too much. Maybe he's too calm. Maybe he should be. So all those voices I don't really hear. But the writers in the writer's room watch you from week to week, and they pick up on little things. They pick up on the fact that you're always fiddling with your top button. You don't know whether you want your shirt closed or open. They pick up on the fact of all these little things that you do, and they're watching you. And if they like you, you start to understand when something's included in next week's script that you do, that they observe, that's you. May not even be the character. And they write that in. You get the sense that they really are respecting who you are and what you do. And then you realize, oh, they're getting inspired by some of the things that they're seeing, and they want that in the script.
Now, Giancarlo, you and Vince together created, in just two seasons and chains, one of the most iconic characters of, you know, television history, I'd say. But to that end, were you ever, did you have like some reservations about revisiting the character in Better Call Saul? Like, did you for a point think that, you know, we did it, it's done, I don't want to tinker with it anymore?
I got to tell you, I was finished.
Yeah.
That's exactly how I felt. Those were my words almost verbatim to myself. What more do I have to show this character? I had, and again, before I joined this show, I had to talk to Vince. And I was hopeful that the show was going to bring something new information about Gus out, even if it was subtle. And Vince and I spoke for a long time, and he said, well, part of the allure and the mystique of Gustavo is that we always want to know more about him. Mm-hmm. And so the majority of who he is in this particular show has to be a mystery as well, which part of me was disappointed by. Like, because I have felt like there's traction and there's merit to a show that would be titled in my brain, The Rise of Gus. And I felt like his story has yet to be told and still could be. Mm-hmm. So if I'm not doing The Rise of Gus, why do I want to go back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then I thought about the experience that I had previously with these writers, and I thought about the idea that Bob Odenkirk is not just a comedian, but a very fine actor. And I thought about the idea that this show could be more about personal relationships than Breaking Bad was, because it's a smaller show that has now grown to be moving in the trajectory of edginess and violence that Breaking Bad started at. So part of the reason I did it was because I thought these will be incredible bookends in our historical film world of a show that was really able to move itself away from being one thing to move itself into being a new thing about a person who has to make a decision about what their life is going to be. Such important things for so many of us in our world, especially in the world as it's moving and transpiring, transferring its energy to a new level today. So we all have that ability and power to make decisions over our personal relationships, and it's certainly a big decision that Jimmy McGill is making to be on the wrong side of the law. But that is where he is. That's where he excels. That's what he's good at. So part of this moral tale of Breaking Bad into Better Call Saul is about making a choice for your life that you love. And as much as I look at Jimmy McGill and he disgusts me as a character, because he has such potential to be what I want him to be, he's being who he really, his true self, who he has come to realize he really is. And I think there's something to be said about that.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, being a little upset about not being able to see as much of Gus's life as, you know, you might want to see on screen. So I wonder, like, for someone like you, when you get a character like Gus and you realize, hey, he's not as there's a lot of work I need to do on the inside to kind of figure out where he's coming from. Do you have like a playbook for what you feel Gus's past is? And adding on to that, how close is any of that even gotten to be, especially in like Better Call Saul? Were there things you thought of that kind of like manifested themselves a little bit when we're seeing a younger Gus in throughout these seasons now?
Well, my challenge going backwards in time was to play someone who was a little less in control, and to try to show that.
Yeah.
To show someone growing to be a person who's going to bring together all the cartels under one roof and he would run it. So it's always a challenge to go, oh, Gus is always so cool and chill, but this is before, so I can let go a little bit. I can be a little angry. I can show a little more emotion than I did previously. So there's always a challenge behind going backwards. I always feel like, and it's part of my journey as an actor, that I have so much to give and I want to give more. And I know I'm going to give, when I give, I'm going to give all of me and my best, because I've done so much research and I've figured out who this person really is and what he really wants. And but I want to be able to show that. And so if the writers aren't giving me that airtime, I have to do what I do in a less with less airtime and less of an ego involved in it, because I want every scene to be indelible. Mm-hmm. So, and then I have to realize my place in the show. You know, it's the show is called Better Call Saul.
Yes,
it's called Better Call Vince. So
that's next show.
You know, so I have to know where my strengths are.
Yeah,
and it's been a joy to be on this show. I tell you, and I realize there are no small parts. You know, whether I have it per episode 5 minutes or 10 or one scene mm-hmm. that takes 2 minutes, I'm going to bring my full game to it, because I respect the story that the writers are trying to tell.
Mm. Well, I'd have to imagine, sorry, Kyle, but I'd have to imagine, just going from what you said, that even still, Gus is probably the top thing you get on the street from people.
There's no doubt about it. I get a lot of recognition from playing Gus. And what I like about the recognition I do get is that it's respectful, mm-hmm. Because it's peppered with a little bit of fear. People don't know if I'm that guy through and through. And yeah. I say to them, well, look, you know, I play that guy, so there's got to be a part of that guy that's like me. Mm-hmm. So when I learned how to act, it was like, take the best and leave the rest. And so, yes, can I be that intense? Yes. Can I stop one of my daughters with just one look? Yes. Is there that inside me somewhere? Yes. Because people are a combination of how they were raised, environment they were raised in, and also they're a combination of their dark and light side. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of them making the choice of, what am I going to be today? Am I mm-hmm. going to be nice Giancarlo, who's, you know, Mr. Yogi, prayerful, mindful, humanitarian human being? Or did I wake up on the wrong side of the bed? Am I going to be inside the skin of one of my, you know, despicable characters? And because you asked this question, and it reminded me of a story when I walked by, I think it was it Fences? No, Kenny Leon was doing the last Denzel play on Broadway. This is going back a few years. Mm-hmm. And I always felt like African-Americans were a little slower than everybody else to catch on to Breaking Bad. Like, mm-hmm. this is like my crowning glory to sit here with YouTube right now. Because, you know, we were a little bit late.
No, yeah.
We were early. We were on time.
Yeah. You were on time.
I admit, I caught on, it was the end of season 2, I think, but I saw one episode, I'm like, damn, I need to binge all this, because season 3 was coming up in a couple of weeks. So by the time season 3 was coming, I was fully on board. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
There you go. So I walked by the theater, they were loading in the show, Denzel was in it, and Kenny Leon was outside with some of the African-American Teamster workers as they were loading in the show. And I was on my way to a voiceover audition in a suit, looking high and tight, just walking. And they stopped me. They were like, oh my God, it's Gus. And Kenny Leon was like, Giancarlo. Wow. Oh my God, it is Giancarlo, but he's Gus. Kelly, I was like, I know. And I stood out there with these brothers for 15 minutes. And they were going on and on about how good Breaking Bad was. Plus, I'm so happy. Pass the word on. We got to it now. Mm-hmm. And I turned to walk away from them. And they've been talking, Gus, 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 Gus. And my whole posture was different. And I'll never forget it. For 2 blocks, I walked. And what's wrong with me? And I went, oh, Gus, get out of here. Get away from here. Get back. Step back, brother. I had become him physically.
Yeah.
Because that juice and love was coming at me. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I was Gustavo, and I said, oh, man, he takes over like that. Mm, so, wow. Yeah, I carry characters with me, and it takes time sometimes to let them go. Mm. But it is important for the actor's psyche to let it go and to put it behind you, because that's where we get confused. I was just saying in a previous interview, you know, look, I play a lot of, and I was talking to Jon Favreau the other day, mm-hmm. we're possibly working on a different project besides Star Wars Mandalorian together, but I realized what I haven't told my children, my 4 daughters, and is that every day that I leave my house, no matter where I am, get in that car, is a little note to myself that happens, that is that little bit of like, okay, take a breath. Not only because I'm out in the world, but also because I have this color skin. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what am I going to share with my children? How I feel. And I sat and I said to myself, well, what do I feel? I feel afraid. Mm-hmm. And that fear to me turns into hypervigilance, anger, and self-defense. Because I'm always looking, it's going to come at me from somewhere for one reason or another. You know? And that made me sad. Yeah. That I'm a successful at my craft and my work and my artistry, but that I still live in fear of a police society.
Yeah. Right.
That might remind me that I'm not only am I a talented, wonderful, committed, creative artist, but that beyond all that, none of that matters. So when all this stuff happened in this country, I said to myself, you know, it don't matter who you are.
Yeah.
It don't matter who you are. So I was really tickled when so much of Hollywood started to share their photos from their homes and got slammed. I knew that was, you know, for banging the pots. I always wanted one of the pot racks that Ellen had. I always wanted one of those pot racks.
It's 7 p.m.?
Yeah, you know, I don't have that kind of home. But I know it was all with good intentions that they wanted to share themselves, but sometimes misguided, I look around my little humble abode that I'm in right now, a little small little house, perfectly fine for me, and I realize how blessed I am. Mm-hmm. I have this space of calm and peace to do my work, talk to you, do my thing. I don't always feel that way out in the world. Yeah. And it's unfortunate. No one should feel this kind of feeling. So I realize, man, I got a little work to do too. Mm-hmm. Because I'm holding a lot of anger from years of being stopped unjustly, put on the ground, cuffed a couple of times, told, you know, all those things I've experienced as well. So, but I have hope that humanity is going to come back and we're going to wrestle with this problem and finally get some legislative change on the books so people can feel not just it's hearsay, that their voices are really being heard, mm-hmm. that something's really going to change. I think it's time for that.
Yeah, really put some play into action.
Yes, exactly right. And it can happen now because we've gone to a new level. You know, still some violence happening around, but I also believe that some of these marches have been co-opted. You know, look, right here in Albuquerque, New Mexico last night, you know, National Guard was pulled out and there was a group of, you know, basically, and I don't want to, you know, downplay it. Mm-hmm. I wish I could get their name exactly right, but they are of that white supremacist ilk. At a rally, mm-hmm. someone got shot. They were responsible because they're trying to create this, you know, mass upheaval mm-hmm. for a reason. So, but I believe that in the end, you know, look, man, it's for the people by the people.
Yes,
definitely.
You know, and I'll just say our leadership is sorely lacking and sorely off the rails.
Yeah.
And so when you see that happening, we need to save his ass too, because he needs to go, right? Because otherwise, something horrible is going to happen.
Yeah,
no, you know what I mean.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He's living in a delusion, his delusionary state. I understand it. I get it. Part and parcel how he was raised, age. We get rigidity in his thinking, all that stuff. He thinks his position is other than what it is. Mm-hmm. See, in his brain, that's his position. In my brain, man, you stand up, you make a statement, you make a speech, you talk to people, you go, hey, let's just cool out. This is what I'm going to do. I'll hold myself responsible. We'll sit down and talk. Let's chill this out for all people. Let's get to the table and work it out. We're not hearing any of that. So people get frustrated, you know?
Yeah,
definitely.
You know, I feel like we keep having the same conversation, but I think this situation's hitting different, and I think a lot of it's because everybody was forced to be home because of COVID-19, you know? It's seeing a black man murdered by the police on a cell phone camera is not new to anybody who's been paying attention for years. You know, I think a lot of people who may not have paid as much attention couldn't turn their eyes away from, you know, that 8 minutes and 46 seconds. You know, I'm hoping, you know, that, you know, again, the plans and the comments that everybody are being making about change can be put into action. It's an election year. You know, this is the time to make a lot of those changes, especially with leadership, whether it's at a state level, government level, what have you. This is not a politics podcast, but this shit is important, y'all. And you got to pay attention because we don't want this happening further on down the line.
No, and we in our world of entertainment, I mean, I feel slightly responsible for all those Law and Orders I did. You know, I played a lawyer there, but I played police officers in a few different venues. And, you know, I sit here thinking as the world revolves, how much have I lent to the feeling that the police have ultimate power? Because I played those officers. Mm-hmm. Every day now, I look and see more and more uncovering stories about African-American officers who have slighted their own people as well, or who were embarrassed to be on that front line, dispatching tear gas and pepper spray, knowing that against their own people. So, you know, it's systemic and endemic in the way that we as a people have, you know, we fear, you know, we go two blocks into the African-American hood and we're like, okay, we're in the hood, lock the doors, roll up the windows. That thinking alone.
Yeah.
You see some black folks, you got to, I was in Cape Town doing a movie last year, man. They told me when you roll up to a stop sign or a stop light, don't get right on the car in front of you. Leave yourself enough space to get out. You can never have your window below crack that much. That much dangerous because they pull your window down and rob you.
Aggressive.
And they're Africans who are doing that in Cape Town, right? So it's like, wait, really? Oh, they'll rob you as quick as they'll rob me, the white teamster told me. You know, golly, really? You know, so we're talking about a world where we have to look at things in a completely different light because it has been so instilled in us as African Americans.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, to be afraid of our own people. It's crazy. So I have to take responsibility for some of the roles I've played may have led to having police officers being in a bad light. Now, I can't believe that most of us as African Americans, and I'll get off this in a second, but you two don't know a black or a white police officer. You know police officers. I do too. So all this went down, all this anger, and all this, just, and I thought about my past, all the incidents I could go through visually, all the times that indecent and illegal things happened to me by the police. Either I got out, or I didn't, or I had to go to jail, or got whatever it was, right? And all that anger still plays on me. But then I sat here and thought about my buddy Rich Richmond, police officer in Austin, Texas, and I went, oh. And then I thought about my other buddy who's a cop, and I went, wait a minute now. So, you know, don't go with the flow of thinking everyone's bad.
Yeah.
Because Rich is a good cop. And I know other good police officers. So, but we get into that thinking, just like we think, you know, don't drive down. Now, I wouldn't go down Cornell because that goes through Martin Luther King and that's what you're
You know what I mean? Yeah. That's real.
You don't want to be there.
Those are real conversations, yeah.
You mentioned some kind of pushback to your celebrity peers. So, and speaking of that, I want to get your thoughts on the I Take Responsibility initiative that came out last week. What are your feelings about that?
I love Aaron Paul. You know, there's a bunch of three or four actors in there that I know. Stanley Tucci. You know, look, their hearts are in the right place.
Yeah.
Right? But the one thing I thought about it was everyone was trying to be so damn sincere, and I understand if they ask me to do that, I've tried to be sincere too, right? But the other part of it was there wasn't enough color in there.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. I just felt like, wait, what did you guys miss something here?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, if I were producing that, I would have coupled people up, black and white. I would have asked every one of those actors to bring their favorite friend who's African-American, Asian, Indian, whatever, do it with them. Because you know they're going to get slammed. I look at that thing, I was like, so sincere. My eyes were tearing up a little bit. It almost had me.
Yeah.
But there wasn't enough color represented there. And so I understand. Like, maybe I need to speak out to this more because my feelings are really real because I'm an actor, so I go to moments that have lived for me. And I, you know, look, I go all the way back 25 years ago when I got stopped at my former wife, who's white, mother of my children, on the Brooklyn Bridge for changing lanes. And I had used my blinker. They insisted I didn't. They came out of their cars with guns on me. And I'm, you know, on an early date with the future mother of my children. And they came both sides, guns drawn completely. I'll never forget it. Like, wow. I was like, that's it. That ruined my date. This woman I'm falling in love with, she's gonna be running from me. You know what I mean? I remember that like it was yesterday. So when you talk about this article, I think maybe the suggestion might have been to have them come up with a personal story so that we don't feel like it's just white speaking to black. I have experience, which is why all these interviews are reminding me to speak to my daughters, you know, to speak to my girlfriend in Europe's son, who's six, you know, to know what to expect. I don't want them to be hypervigilant like me or in fear, but I can speak to it from a visceral standpoint because even down to the last shooting last week, like the dude grabbed taser at Wendy's. No, I mean, you can't do that. Ran away, pointed it back at them. No, you're just pushing the envelope to get that bullet in you. But even with all that, I can understand that. He was afraid.
Yes. It's his life.
He turned and booked. He tried to protect himself. He was scared. He was afraid. And he was also, whatever he was on, he was on.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, I look at that and believe me, I say, that could be me. That 100%. Could be, and not in the movies. Because I'm a good runner. And I would be hauling ass out of there just like he did. And to get shot in the back, such a tragic, horrible thing.
I'm wondering, because, I mean, you've spoken, you know, just with, you know, in the last, you know, 10, 15 minutes talking about different experiences you've had being pulled over and things like that. But it's, you're also in, I don't want to say a different experience, but because you were originally, you know, not born in America, you came into America as a child, right?
That's right. So I came here at 6 years old from Italy. I came over on a boat.
Did you have any concept, like was race or anything even a concept in coming to America? How did you learn these types of things? Especially the fact that like you are a black person and that is seen differently to certain people in America.
I learned it in America from Americans. I came here, my mother was really disturbed. We were in Germany before we left. We wound up in Italy. My father's from Naples. My mother's from Alabama. We were in Germany. African man came to deliver the groceries at the front door. We opened the door. My mother said, get the door. We opened the door and my brother started screaming immediately, Schwarzer, Schwarzer, Schwarzer. He freaked out and ran into the closet. I followed him in there. My mother came to the door and saw what we were talking about. Blue, black, Nigerian, delivering the groceries. And she realized we have a problem here. Because they don't see that I'm black and their father, Giovanni, is white. So that's when she realized, oh, they don't see color. So I came to America and I saw color. Because she had to educate us. Because we would go to church and the sisters would say, oh, you got that good hair. The good hair. Your hair do anything, won't it? It goes straight or curly, whatever you need, right? And, oh, you're different. Look at them long eyelashes. And they look cocoa skin, you know? So she started to prepare us that we would be looked at differently. And thus came my being ostracized in this place I call and love America. I call it America. But I was ostracized from a young age by both black and white because I didn't fit, didn't belong. That was a problem. And I started to be accepted in the African-American community after my work started to reveal itself that I was an artist. And so after doing the right thing, things started to happen because people were like, oh, because people would like, oh, he's Spanish, he ain't black. You know, they would put you in your little box. And so I learned this hypervigilance from my experiences in my life. And it's just different than anyone else's. And each incident can be different for all of us as African-Americans, but what links us up is that there's always that possibility. There's always that possibility that something out of the ordinary could happen and that I have to stay as calm as I can be to preserve my life. And, you know, so how often are you walking down the street in Manhattan and the police car, you know, kind of cruises up to you and checking you out, it's going slow, doesn't say anything. Do you feel like, oh, like that's intimidation? But, you know, it is. It's that scare tactic that police use while they size you up to see if you're a candidate. And that's unfortunate. But it will change. It can change.
Unpack that a little bit. Cause, I mean, you know, being an actor, being in Hollywood, one of the things that has been coming up, whether it's the Me Too movement or now, a lot of people are reexamining the constructs within their particular industries. And I know Hollywood's always one. And anytime award season comes around, you know, Oscar's so white, you know, there's a lack of, you know, diversity, whether it's here, Britain, whatever, you know, it's a problem worldwide. What do you think Hollywood needs done, or what do you think young creatives in Hollywood should be starting to do to help change that system from the inside out?
Well, I think you really have to be sensitive and go through the right channels. And I believe that is most important, because when you represent yourself in the correct way with the right words and the right statements and the right protocol, people have to listen. They have to listen. There's no way around that. You're not screaming. You're not irate. You're not angry. You're laying out the code for the new world. And believe me, this has to happen. We take two steps forward and five steps back. And we have a year in Hollywood where there's been truly unconventional casting, and we have African-Americans who've excelled, who've been up for awards, and we go from that to nothing. You know, it's really kind of unbelievable and amazing. So I do believe that as our stories start to become more universal, mm-hmm. then people will start to understand the pain that African-Americans have gone through, the complete, we've been ostracized, we've been put out of business. The African-Americans who go into business, become successful, are on their own,
mm-hmm. yeah,
right? Because it's taken them so long to get where they need to be, and they're looking back going, sorry, you know? Some yeah. are reaching back to help, but others are like, whew,
yeah,
I'm here.
I got out.
Yeah.
Get out of what? He's still in the world.
He's still here. He's still here.
So it's really, really interesting. But I think that our stories will start to illuminate the progress that we're about to make. Mm-hmm. Because as we, and I encourage young filmmakers, actors, performers, artists to create their own stories. Write their stories with creativity. Write them and tell them as they are true to be. So that people can really see and understand and feel. That it's not just, you know, that our voices aren't going to be falling on deaf ears. That people really, really will understand. What do they understand? They understand family. They understand connection between their children to their daughters and their sons and their fathers and their mothers. They understand those stories. I got a text from dear friend Steve Chisholm, anesthesiologist, worked so hard in Long Island, in Bayshore, in a hospital. He's been on the COVID unit for 3 months, mm-hmm. seeing death and he's wrote me and said, man, fuck, excuse my language, my parents had to go through this. I had to go through this, and now my kids have to go through this.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people are feeling that way. So that means people are ready for change. Mm-hmm. They're ready for change. They're ready to look at you and I and go, oh, okay. And you know that look that you get. That look you get is, oh, you're an educated black man. It's like, I'm speaking to someone I didn't expect to be speaking to. Mm-hmm. Well, what did you expect?
I'm not going to name any names, but just being in this position in terms of talking to actors and directors from films and TV shows, it's funny being that black guy in the press junket and you get the, you know, the 5 minutes, 7 minutes, whatever with someone, and they're like, that was a really good conversation. It's like, yeah, I've been doing this for a while.
For a little while.
I guess you thought we were going to talk about Jay-Z and sneakers, but you know, we can do this. You know, we can do this thing here. Now, getting back to, you know, I appreciate all the wise words you shared about, you know, the system and the way the world is today. But I do want to get back into Gus a little bit.
Please.
Just because when this final season, this is going to be the last time you're playing Gus. Is it
again?
Is it weird now leaving Gus? Was it weirder now than it was back when Breaking Bad was ending?
Oh, much weirder. You asked such good questions. Yeah, because I played in another incarnation. I got my whistle wet again. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, so we've done Walter White, we've done Saul Goodman, now we can do Gus. Yeah, you know what I mean. It's very weird because I thought I was done, mm-hmm. and I really, really, and it wasn't a ploy for money or anything else. When I had that moment in time, where do I really want to go back and do this again? It was really about how long. What I think about a lot of things. Do I want this character to define my whole career? I don't see how it can. It's certainly a crowning glory. But I've done mm-hmm. so many other things in this last year. I've done 4 other TV shows.
Yes.
And all reputable. Mandalorian, The Boys, Dear White People. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had the opportunity to, and very, very proud of, and a show you must see, I'm sure you're onto it, Godfather of Harlem.
Godfather of Harlem.
Because it really exemplifies a contemporary revisit of the movement that we are back in now. Mm-hmm. Back then, it's the you know, Swizz Beatz music is brilliant. It's a brilliant retelling of that freedom story that we have to make good on now. So, you know, I feel like, I'm ready to be finished. Let him go, because mm-hmm. The blessing for me with the advent of cable television and 13 episodes is it's not like the 26 or 22 you do in network TV where you're that character all year long, every year. I've done 5 other shows. I've been other characters. It's been a blessing. But it'll be nice to finally release Gus to the ether. Mm-hmm. Yes, because there's something about beginnings and endings that are very, very important. Beginnings are, you know, that anticipation and wonder of creating something new and wonderful that might be different or perceived in a different light, that might show me and my talent as an actor in a way that no one's ever seen before. Mm-hmm. That's the beginning. The anticipation, the wonder, the excitement, the collaboration, the creativity. And then the end is, you know, it's like the beginnings and endings. The end is the bookmark, is the completion, is the fruition, is did I do it? Did I convince the audience? Did I do all that I set out to do? And that's satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And to have that satisfaction, it's like when you do something in your life, set yourself up for success. Because you want to have that feeling of being satisfied and complete. I did that. I made this 5-minute short film. I did it. It has my view, my vision, and what I think about what's happening in the world right now, and its creator. Mm-hmm. That stands for me. So for me, my work speaks for itself and stands up to injustice and other things by the characters that I choose to play for a reason. Mm-hmm. And fortunately for me, I've had the ability to make those good choices.
Yeah, I want to follow through on your choices too, because I'm sure that, you know, once you play such a visible, beloved character like Gus, you can kind of be in danger of people approaching you wanting you to do a similar thing. And you've been very good about dodging that.
I really have. It's asked of me quite a bit. Could you sprinkle a little more Gus into it? And yet when I agree to do the gig, this guy is nothing like Gus, but yet they want that. They want that Gus centeredness, that Gus calmness. So I try to avoid it when I can, because that's reserved for Gus. I'm sorry. I can create I can create that feeling in another way by creating a different kind of nefarious feeling or attitude about the character. But yes, I don't want to repeat. I feel like, you know, to me, to repeat is just to be playing yourself. And I always feel like I want to be out of my own skin in playing someone who is completely new to me, that I have to discover. And that discovery is the journey of an actor.
Now, you mentioned, you know, you said nefarious. It does seem like, though, you do enjoy playing the heavy on quite a bit of these shows. You know, Moff Gideon is definitely shaping up to be of that antagonistic nature.
Yes. Well, the Moth is someone who wants to control the world in many regards. Part of him wants to save the universe because it's all collapsed. But the other part too, and Gus had a bit of this. Moth is a little different. He's a little more hot-headed and he likes to fight and does his own fighting. But he also feels like he can do it better. Like, you know, I can put this universe together, back together in a better way. And what we don't know about Moth is intriguing, is how he knows everything. Like, he knows about people. He has information. And that, you know, for me, is a reflection of the world we're in now. It's all information. Who has the information and can recite the information back and is so very important in our society today about people's record, about what they've done in the last 5 years. I mean, you know, all of that, it plays right into the political aspect of our country. Mm. You know, don't forget. Have a good memory to know what's been going down for the last 100, 200 years so you can be informed for it not to happen again.
Well, shit, he, Moff's got the information. He's got also got that damn Darksaber. I mean, it was cool to see, you know, I wish we had gotten more. I'm assuming when season 2 comes later this year, we'll get a lot more Moff. But I wanted to see you swinging that thing around a little more before the season 1 ended. So I'm ready. I'm ready for season 2.
It's coming. We got some action swinging of the saber. I tell you,
doing your own stunts.
Oh yeah. I mean, they have a great stunt crew who just, you know, we get in there not a lot of time, but sometimes even on the day and. Really just train up and do it. But yeah, I did all my own stunts on that. And I'm very excited at the team that they put together. Yeah. This show is just, to be working on a show in this universe is, I tickle myself every day. I truly do. I went back and looked at some of the old Moffs. There was one in Peter Cushing, a 40s actor who was excellent in one of the Star Wars trilogy movies. Because I had I watched the first few movies, but I didn't have a lot of information in terms of being a Star Wars fanboy. So I went back and looked at a lot of stuff so I could feel what this universe was. And what is different about our Mandalorian world is that it is a true Western that encompasses the mythology of Joseph Campbell.
Yeah.
And that's important. And important for our African-American community to know about Joseph Campbell and the power of myth, because we, in all communities, our young sisters and brothers and children, sons and daughters, need to know that that hero mentality can be theirs too. That that is something that we have to aspire to, figuring out how to be our own heroes, because we haven't had many role models, and figuring out how to be the hero and champion of someone else, because to share that and pass it down puts us in a place where we understand that that nature of heroism, feeling important, feeling like enough, feeling equal, feeling like we have a contribution, has been lost in our community.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we have a contribution, and that contribution in the days to come is going to become more and more important to this society, because we will be asked, you know, how does it feel? And you can describe that feeling, and you can put it into words of why you feel that way, and you can put it into words that why no one should feel this way. And then people will start to understand people differently on a larger scale. They'll get it. Like, are we really thinking that we don't have some of the same hopes and dreams that other people have? Are we really thinking that ours are so different? Is it really too much to ask to be justifiable in your criticism?
To be
justifiable in your view that not every person is the same? We haven't even talked about folks who are running around with mental illness who are immediately put down. So the whole system needs to be changed, and I think it's moving in the right direction to help people where help is necessary and needed, and to have an understanding of people, because that one step back for half a second can give you the whole person's whole story, you know, which would guide you to deal with them in a different way. And this is what we're going to come to. The people are going to become more astute at reading each other.
I think that's probably why, I mean, I, when you're saying it, I'm thinking about how I've seen myself or been able to, I don't want to say quantify, but kind of like justify our existence as a Black community. And again, I mentioned Bugging Out and Do the Right Thing earlier. The movie recently just turned 30 years old, I think, and it keeps coming up, you know, whether it's just looking at a protest because one community felt they were not being represented compared to another one, police issues, or just the fact that, hey, I want to see myself. You know, I appreciate being able to see a Black person on screen. It's always been my thing. Who's that Black guy? That's how I learned about people like you and character actors in general, because, hey, you see that Black person, I follow the Black guy. You know what I'm saying? And I think because I thought it was me, or I thought it, you know, I didn't know what it was. That's probably where my love of movies and TV came from. But I know, like, being around kids, like 3 and 4 year olds, especially, you know, children of color, they gravitate towards it. If it's a little Black boy, he wants to see Black Panther on screen because, hey, someone that looks like me, they're a superhero as well, you know, or they're just a guy that, you know, happens to run the local store or whatever it is, you know. It doesn't have to be the same depictions and things that turn into, you know, stereotypes because of color and things like that. So I think when you mentioned earlier about young creatives telling their stories in a creative way, I mean, that's Do the Right Thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's a lot of these films that landmark films, especially for African-American actors and filmmakers and producers, that it's those types of stories that, at least for me, helped show me that I wasn't alone. And I think I can hope that we can get to that more now.
You know? Absolutely. Like, I feel like I'm in another club being a part of Hollywood. And there's so many actors out there who are African Americans who no one knows their names. You see them in bit parts here and there, and they're never destined to be a star. But those folks also need a strong amount of recognition because they forged a place for themselves. And so I went from, you know, the outsider club, literally from feeling so outside of this strange place that we call America, because I was unacceptable being a mixed race person, to part of a club when I was successful, because I did what I do because I love it and do it well. So it's a strange place to be because I'm at this club that is not hasn't always honored my African American side, hasn't always honored my Italian side, and certainly has yet to honor my mixed culture, my mixed race side.
That's
a whole other story that I think we need to start to tell those stories too, because those are important. Just like the conversation going on in my family with my four black daughters saying, okay, do you understand your mama? There's some resentment there right now because you look at her and you see white. But you're falling for the bait. Why don't you look at her and see you came out of her belly? But you want to down her for her supposed white privilege? Do you really understand what that means? Do you understand in the context of that who she is? But these conversations, like the one in my family is happening, is so very important. It's important not only to my career and what I've done, but to help me realize part of the reason I didn't move to Hollywood was because I didn't want to be tainted. I didn't want to be special. I want to be, you know, committed to my work. And I really, truly love what I do. I'm not a celebrity because I don't just use my celebrity to be the celebrity star. I'm not the huge matinee idol movie star. No, I'm commit, you know, who might play themselves over and over again, but they're so handsome that they're the matinee idol. No, I'm the guy who says, look, this is what I was meant to do and I love it. And I want to inspire people, all people, not only African-American people and Indian people and Chinese people, but all people. The stories I'm interested in are the stories that are told that we can all relate to. And that's what this media is doing for us, you know? Yeah. And the more we understand different cultures, the more, you know, I go back to Martin Luther King, who was so moving to me, and Malcolm X, because it's the politics of fear that have us not understand each other. Now, when you walk on a movie set, you're in a club. You're part of the family. We understand each other. Right? It's assumed because we're doing something for a common goal. And now it's reflective. And that common goal, some people there may, you know, have an agenda, you know, because back in the day when TV and film showed only one side of our culture, you know, they had an agenda to keep it that way because people wanted to feel safe and soothed and sated and cool. And there's not going to be any, you know, excuse me, but ain't going to be no monkeys running through the neighborhood. It's all good, you know. And so it's the fear. And so I realized we fear people who are different than we are. Why? Because we don't know what their culture is. Well, why don't we get to know it? Why don't we get to know it so we can be more comfortable and have an understanding if we're interested? But that's been the problem. You know, no, we haven't been accepted yet. And so our acceptance and my acceptance into Hollywood, I'm grateful for because it's built on meritocracy, on what I do, on how I perform and how I do it. Just like the black man yesterday who called the police, he said, okay, I'm calling. He had a friend of the police force who he knew. Brother had dreadlocks. He was an inspector. He had dreadlocks. He probably packing the whole deal, but he was African-American man who looked oh so black. So he said he had to call. I'm going to this neighborhood. I got to go door to door checking meters or whatever he was inspecting. But he let the police know he was going in case there was any pushback. And he, you know, because now they see a black man in their yard checking their meter. It's like, oh, call the police. You know, so now we're able, some of these stories that are coming out will be able to be made into films that are heartwarming and beautiful, that allow us to be part of each other's cultures and understand what we've gone through, thus engendering more respect, right? More understanding. Oh, I get it. Okay, then I can say to you after you tell me a story, I can ask you, can you put that aside for a second and look at it this way? I understand your pain. I respect it. I understand what's happened to you. Now look at it this way. Then the conversation can happen because we understand each other better.
You mentioned Malcolm X, and I just remember when I rewatched the film. I guess it was in February. It was on Netflix. I forgot that your character is one of the brothers that helped take him out. Was it weird, like reading for a movie, knowing full well that, like, hey, I'm going to be one of those guys that gets his ass kicked because I helped kill Malcolm X.
So weird, because I had studied up on the assassins, and Talmadge Hayer, who I played, was one of them. He had a couple of different names. Thomas 10X was one of his names, wasn't even really corroborated that he was, that all of them were really there. He was there.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. went to jail, and about 5 or 6, 7, 8 years ago got out of prison.
Wow.
But certainly very weird to play that role in such a powerful film. One of the people who wanted to silence his voice. I think there was a lot of complicity involved in X's death with the FBI and the police department. They needed to silence him, as all of our great leaders at that time were silenced, black and white. But very, very important film for me to be a part of, because it, again, why part of the reason to be look at my blessings as an actor is to revisit history, to learn more about what the real facts were, mm-hmm. to find out what the personal stories were. And it's informative of my life that I can dive into a role and take it that seriously, to learn the historical pillars that have happened during history to inform me that, okay, where we're at now. Mm-hmm. And again, I go back to watching that Minnesota Police Department burn, hearing that chant of no justice, no peace, one night last week at 11 after George Floyd, and thinking, this is doing the right thing. This is doing the right thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I had tears in my eyes. I went, wow, this is the movie. Spike was way ahead of his time. And then the sadness hit me because, you know, that was 1989. Mm-hmm. You know, another summer. You know, and we're in 2000. We're 2020.
It's crazy.
And we're still dealing with this. All I can say is, man, I'm just trying to spread love, get the legislation changed, tell white folks that I love you. I'm not worried about you. I want you to know me. Why can't we have that reaction? I want you to know me. Definitely. Why don't you sit down with me and know me? Things are about to change drastically.
Yeah. Well, I think
wise words.
Finally, and in an effort to get to know you, I have to ask. I saw a note that back in the day you used to live with Lawrence Fishburne. You guys were roommates
at one time. Yes, indeed.
I can't imagine that should be a series right there.
Yes, that could be a series right there.
Without getting yourself in trouble, like, do you remember one of like the craziest times you two had? Because I guess you guys were young actors in New York, just trying to make it.
I went to L.A. for a work search on a show, and Lawrence was there, and we were both auditioning, and we met, and we became fast friends immediately. Before we ever even worked together, we were trying to figure out how we're going to work together, mm-hmm. and we both went away from that gig. I don't think either of us got that pilot. And I went back to New York, and Lawrence hung out in L.A. And I called him. He said, hey, man, I got a place. You got a place? I said, yeah, I need to come out for a work search. He said, I got a place for you. He said, okay, where are you at? I got a loft down on Vignette Street. I said, oh, wow, it sounded all posh and great and cozy and whatnot. And I get there. My second day there, I connect with Lawrence. Yeah, you can come stay. And we went down the alley, stepped on a 5-gallon, you know, paint can to get to a window, went through the window, and this is my loft. I said, oh, okay. I mean, it was a mess. He said, I'm going to put this here, this here, this here, and we're going to make this thing. And I was like, oh, Lawrence, man, this place needs way too much work. I don't even think we had a toilet. We took that 5-gallon paint can and we were going to the bathroom and that for a couple of weeks.
Oh, my God.
We have lived through it. But we made our auditions and tried to get work. I think I left after about a month. I was so grateful to have a place on the hard concrete to sleep, put my head down. But we were crazy back then. And without getting me into any more trouble, I'm going to shut up.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, I think that'll do it for us today, Giancarlo. Thank you
so much.
Greatly appreciate that. The work you've done as Gus in Better Call Saul, but again, just throughout your career. Blessed to have you on the podcast.
I want to give a quick shout out to a role you did in recent year that we didn't talk about. Cal's gonna laugh because I always scream about the show when I get a chance because it's so underrated. But uh-huh. Jet with Carlo Gugino was one of my favorite shows of last year.
It is really so well done by Sebastian Gutierrez, who directed and produced and wrote every episode. It is a fascinating show that really takes that noir crime drama to another level. Carla is impeccable. I really enjoy doing that show. And that was all last year, too. I had a good year. It's always great to talk to you guys. I mean, it's just what a pleasure and an honor to be in such a great conversation.
Appreciate you.
Thank you so much, man.
Another classic. It's got to be Giancarlo, bless the pod with a great conversation. For me personally, again, as a fan of his work, but also just a fan of important conversation, I think I don't know how this is not a top five again so far. It's going to be a high bar after Giancarlo blessed the pod, which he should, you know, appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, every time that I post one of these each week, you know, I never want to be corny and say, oh, new favorite or new, like, yeah, bucket list guest or whatever. It seems like I'm just doing a shtick, but it kind of is, you know, always shifting.
Yeah, yeah. Shouts out to being able to get better with every episode. I love what we're doing here. But before we get out of here this week, we mentioned at the top of the show that the best TV shows of 2020 so far dropped on the Pop Culture Channel on Complex. You can head over there and check that out. 20 shows. Don't want to spend too much time talking about a lot of them, but were there any, what would you say would have been?
Well, I think the one thing that comes up with mid-year, uh-huh, that's always, because we run into this in December as well, because you run into it about more so on music, but mm-hmm, when you decide to publish, determines what might not make the cut.
Yes.
And, you know, mid-year, that happens even more so. So I think a big one that people might be reading this list and wondering where it is I May Destroy You, which I don't know if you've checked that out yet.
With everything work-wise and everything else going on, I've not had a lot of time to devote to that. But I love Michaela.
But you don't need to. Yeah, I was going to say you don't even need to worry about that because you're big Michaela Hyde.
Yeah, I love. And I know it's half-hour episodes.
Yeah, it's going to be an easy watch when you can get to it.
Yeah, once I start, I know, and it's not over yet though, right? Is it 10 episodes? I think there.
Well, no, that's what I was going to bring up. So it's like that's a show that came out of the gate really fire and. Plus, a lot of critics were given the entire season, but you know, we can't really publish to that, even though we have access to those episodes. We can't get ahead of that. So
it's tough.
You know, at the time we were making this list, I think one or two episodes have been out, so it's just not eligible at this point. But that is going to be a big one, end of year.
Definitely. Don't be surprised if you see it on the final end of year list in December. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one. And again, it probably would have been a different situation, but I do know that when we're doing these lists, it's hard. It's really hard to include something that's not complete at that time, or at the very least complete for a certain amount, like a mid-season thing. I could see that happening. Yeah, two or three episodes in when we're doing it, unfortunately. It's not enough time to develop. December, we'll make it work. I'm glad we got Dare Me on there, though.
Yes, RIP.
I didn't realize that it was no longer on Netflix. It's on Hulu. It was on Netflix.
Whatever works. Whatever helps people realize they fucked up.
2 months? Three? Not even? We were in quarantine when that hit Netflix. But yeah.
Yes, for sure.
It sucks that it's one season that ends on a crazy cliffhanger, but it's in terms of just like good television this year, structurally, I mean, the acting isn't my favorite throughout the show, but I love the story and I love the way the story was told. I'm actually really sad that Jeremy's not coming back. So,
yeah,
it's
definitely go check out our Marlo Kelly episode though.
Back in those archives, baby.
You pulled the executive decision and we got Dave on here, which I do respect because this can't just be a Frasier list or it can't be a Kelly list.
There's too many people.
We gotta do it for the people too. And for some reason, all of you guys fuck with Dave.
Yeah. It's
God bless.
We've had this conversation on the pod before, but I can't, and I've gone back and I've been watching more Dave and there's a good show there. It's just that it's surrounding
Lil Dicky. Yeah, I mean, I don't contest that either. I just don't like Lil Dicky. So.
I feel you. Did it get a season 2? I think it got a season 2.
Oh, how could it not? How could it not being a smash like that?
Yeah, beating Atlanta. It's going to be one of those shows that I'm going to have to check out just because of the conversation, but it's not like appointment. Like I might end up streaming the entire thing before we have to make a decision for a list. You feel what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, again, there are too many of our peers, too many people in the audience loving Dave to nix it.
Now, we mentioned our top two, Better Call Saul and Curb. Mm-hmm. Curb definitely, if there was no Better Call Saul, I think Curb has an easy shot at number one. 100%. We talked about this on a pod too not too long ago. Mm-hmm. Curb is one of those shows where it's like the fact that it even is still delivering at this level is impressive unto itself.
Crazy, crazy.
And when you remove those guardrails from it, like, you know, that benchmark, it's still just great TV. And it was a really soothing thing to have in quarantine. I wish more of the season extended into quarantine.
Actually. Yeah, it definitely set up, because you figure what? It was what, the last like three episodes maybe?
Right.
It did, and it was funny because one of those episodes, what was the finale? Or was it episode 9 when it was like mad fucking
Purell, yeah.
It was, you know, he didn't know what he was doing, but he really spoke that into existence.
Exactly.
No, but yeah, again, if Saul hadn't dropped yet, and B just wasn't as good as it was, Kerr would have been an easy one.
I mean, you know, from the way everyone talks about Saul, I don't see that dropping very much for the rest of the year. I mean, we got a lot of time. 6 months is a lot of TV time.
Yeah.
And literally 100 relevant shows can drop between now and Christmas.
A lot of good TV coming. This list could absolutely change, especially for like the latter. Like the latter half of this list is going to be interesting to see what makes and what doesn't make it.
Well, if we want to talk about divisive comedies that got a second season really quick, Black as Fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, you know, speaking about the fucking particle accelerator that's quarantine, that feels like it was a year ago.
It feels forever.
And it was what, March, April?
It was March. I probably watched it like 4 times now. Maybe I'm the one that likes it. I don't know. I'm fine with it.
No, I mean, I thought it was cool. It's one of those shows where, you know, when we talk about this with Cord, it's been a conversation that's been happening a lot recently. We might actually need to dedicate like a whole pod to this, get back on our TV nerd shit. Mm-hmm. Apparently, you guys like when we get nerdy, as long as it's accessible. But,
shouts to y'all.
You know, in today's climate with streaming and how many shows can be greenlit at one time, how much attention you're fighting for, a lot of shows don't get to live up to their potential.
No.
And when you look at a lot of past favorites, that potential was reached in later seasons.
Yeah.
So, you know, Black as Fuck to me is a show that I thought was cool. I liked some of the ideas behind it.
Yeah.
Some of the execution, didn't like some of the execution. Yeah. But it is a show I think has the potential to really get better and grow into itself into season 2. So I'm not hating on that renewal at all.
And you have to remember, too, that, like, this is Kenya's first, like, real acting. You know what I'm saying? Like, it may sound easy to be like, yeah, let's make a show like her, but I can imagine for someone that is not an actor, even though he's a funny guy and is a writer, doing that in front of the camera it can't be easy. When I saw that it got renewed for season 2, I didn't realize it was under 50% on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's better than that. But my hope is that whatever season 2 is, they learn from some of, like, you know, they take the training wheels off, learn from some of the things that didn't work as well, and start on that path of continuing better season after better season after better season. It's just going to suck because I'm going to hate that the little baby is going to be too old to not sound cute when he says I shit my diaper or whatever. Because that's still that's still the number one punchline in that entire show.
I guess it's just to bring it full circle and wrap it up. If we're going back into the archives,
yes,
about shows we talked about this year leading up to this list, a show that I was glad did not make the cut, because another thing that happens with mid-year is you end up giving out a lot of participation trophies.
Yes.
Right? It's not as cutthroat.
Word.
To be on the best 20 when you're just at the halfway mark. So I'm not mad at Outer Banks not making it. I don't know if you finished it since we finished it, but I finished it, and I wasn't mad I watched it. I was entertained by it. But when you look at the other shows that it's kind of getting compared to, like on the CW or some of those old Fox shows from way back in the day, like it really is like a first draft version of all of those shows.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's the most mailed in. Like, so you didn't finish it, right?
No.
Dude, the bad guy has no. It's bad when you watch something that you know is supposed to be a turn your brain off exercise.
Yeah,
and you still can't help but ask questions. Like, I love turn your brain off shit. I got to the end of the show. I was like, wait, I'm gonna have to spoil it for you.
It's fine.
The homie Jasmine watched, right?
Jasmine watched. Shout out super producer Jasmine. Sorry.
The homie is the richest man on the island. Yeah. But he's out here murking people over like millions of dollars. Like, I get Apex like billionaire mindset. Like, there's always more money, but come on. Like, I thought he was going to have like some secret connection. I thought that,
It's like two mil.
No, it's a lot of money. I hate that. I don't know if we got to this in that episode, but I hate now watching any type of heist movie where the bread is not worth the effort. That drives me so crazy.
Like, we're about to get $50,000, y'all.
Five Bloods. And I mean, it works for Five Bloods because, you know, black men in America,
with
some of the raw deal we've been given, of course you're going to go into the jungle for just a couple like million. But I'm thinking that split, like $2 million,
what are you going to do?
I don't know if you're really retiring off that in Trump's America.
It's $2 million between five of them. The one girl's already rich. The other kid is probably just going to use it for school. Oh, it's four, right?
Yeah.
So they get $5 million apiece. Yeah, I don't. That's not good.
So Outer Banks had it was going for like $300 million or something stupid like that. But they never explain why the rich dude is beasting so hard for all this gold.
It's just the thing.
And then, you know, it's a show that keeps diving into the histories of the town, which one of the shows I always yell at you to watch is The Vampire Diaries, which is a great, great job at, like, threading the past and the present. So it's basically, to me, having watched all these shows before, I'm like, all right, this is telegraphing that we're going to meet the descendant of this ancestor whose gold is stealing. He's going to have a real claim to it because he was a slave that bought his freedom.
Word.
And used it to, like, you know, get his people going.
Mm-hmm.
No, we're not even going to engage in that. The black friend and the group is not going to be like, hey, you know, where's this guy's family?
Oh, my God.
I thought maybe the black friend was going to be the descendant at least.
No.
So they're just leaving so many things on the table that I myself, just the viewer is like, all right, I could think of.
Yeah.
I could humbly think of like 10 different ways you could make this even a little bit more interesting. So
you're making it too hard for yourself. But yeah.
As fun as that was, you know, I'm glad. I use that to say that I'm glad we didn't hand out too many participation trophies either.
I mean, yeah, remember, it was going to be 25 at one point, and I think Outer Banks was going to be somewhere in that bottom area, and it was kind of, what's the point, you know?
Yeah.
What's the point? And realistically, once you get outside of 20, there's only so many shows that could or should make it. So I think we're good. Again, complex.com, go to the pop culture channel, check out the best TV shows of 2020 so far list. Let us know if we got it right. Let us know what you think should have been on there, what you thought should have been number one, all that good stuff. Hit us up on at Complex Pop on Twitter and Instagram. Please get in the conversation. This podcast, Watch Less, drops every Wednesday, 6 a.m. on Apple Podcasts or wherever you guys get your podcasts. Please subscribe, review, comment, share. Whatever you have to do on that service, do that shit so people know who we are and we can keep continuing to bring you content like Giancarlo Esposito interviews, Pamela Adlon interviews, Marlo Kelly interviews, all that shit. We got so many ideas. And we just want to make sure we've got a rabid audience who is ready to consume all of that stuff. I think that's about it. I know the summer man's got to make some summer plans for a future for him. So we're going to hop out of here. For him, my name is Cal. Yes, advising you as always, don't be a dickhead. Wear a mask. 6 feet is still the rule. It's still fucking Corona season. Don't play yourself. I don't care how close we are to 4th of July. Tune in and watch less.
Peace.
Watch Less is hosted by Fraser Tharp and myself, Cal. Our producer is Taliba Newman. Associate producer and sound engineer is Jasmine Plata. Production manager, Chancel Correa. Talent booker, Anthony Allred. Junior booker, Austin Bailey. Our director of talent relations is Kristen Price Harrell. And our Senior Director of Operations is Jen Stewart. Watch Less is a part of the Complex Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.